The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest, Sue Mackenda, sold her business in 2005 and started writing her first novel. She writes gritty fiction with no fluffy clouds or hazy sunsets. Accident of Fate was followed by Accident of Birth in 2017, and her A Date in the Diary series are the stories of three women who were once at boarding school together who receive an invitation to their school reunion. Also with us is Nicola Avery, a trained hypnotherapist, past life therapist and Reiki practitioner. She channels her research and experiences into her writing. Within the Silence is a dark paranormal thriller which unpicks the perfect family tapestry. We also have Nick Pope, who worked for the Ministry of Defence for 21 years, undertaking a wide range of jobs, mainly in the Ministry of Defence headquarters building in Whitehall. His novel, Blood Brothers, looks at when two deadly but very different terror attacks bring carnage to London on the same day. And Andy Shepherd is a children's writer working on middle grade fiction and picture books. The Boy Who Flew with Dragons is the third book in a wonderfully funny series about Thomas and his pet dragon Flicker, who grew on a very special tree at the bottom of his granddad's garden. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Depends in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sue Mackenda, who sold her business in 2005 and started writing her first novel while recovering from an illness. She says it was the best thing she ever did and has turned out to be the most exciting job in the world. She writes gritty fiction. There are no fluffy clouds and hazy sunsets, just an honest reason to find answers and truths no matter what the risk. Accident of Fate was followed by Accident of Birth last year, and A Date in the Diary series are due to come out soon. They're the stories of three women who were once friends at Chartley Independent School as boarders in 1997, who receive an invitation to their school reunion. Welcome to the book show, Sue.
Hi.
Thanks very much for joining us. And I was really excited reading your biography on your website that I kept sharing things with people in the office. There's so many things. There's things I want. There's things I want to ask you about before we even get to books. Like, for example, you coined the phrase "a moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips."
Yes,
and that's amazing.
I know. I actually wish that I'd patented it at the time, but unfortunately not. My children were small and I used to enter competitions, and it was a McVitie's chocolate biscuit competition, that's what I came up with. I came up with that one, and I entered twice. The other one was Dying to Try It Out, Ways Trying to Diet, which wasn't quite so catchy, my prize was a supermarket dash.
So what happened in that? Did you grab as much as you could then?
I did, but unfortunately my freezer chose to break down the day before, and it was mainly sort of dry goods and things, and in those days it wasn't quite so much alcohol.
No. And your sons were a bit embarrassed because there was a photo of Supersonic Sue in the local paper.
Absolutely, yes. I'm afraid I have a habit of embarrassing my sons many times over the years.
And then something else that happened, which sounds amazing. You appeared on breakfast and evening TV and radio and local newspapers when you and your girlfriend dared to play snooker in an all-male club.
Yeah, I'm afraid we weren't expecting what happened to go quite so mad. But it was my girlfriend who contacted something called Erica, which was the Equal Rights in Clubs committee or something up in Yorkshire, and they went to the papers. So that was it. I ended up with Frank Boff, and I can't remember who he was with then at that time. And we did lots of radio interviews and a TV performance, which I die at whenever I watch nowadays. Very cringy. But yes. We did, and we were in the papers for quite a few weeks. Again, my children very, very embarrassed by people shouting out of car windows when we'd walk through the streets and things like that.
Oh, how funny. That would have been Selena Scott, was it, that he was with?
That's right, Selena Scott and Frank Boff.
Yes. Brilliant.
That's right, and Robbie Vincent phoned in, and then the news thing that came after, you know, you get the local news after the BBC News in the evening, and we went out on that, which, yeah.
Fantastic. And you've had lots of different jobs before you started writing as well, haven't you?
Yeah. I've been in recruitment for many, many years, which I'm about to hang my hat up on completely now. And I've owned a maternity nursing agency and also a recruitment agency, a commercial recruitment agency. I had two branches of that. Prior to that, I worked for many, many years at St. Peter's Maternity Hospital and the General Hospital. Yeah, kept me off the streets, as they say.
So what made you want to write a book then?
I've always been a great one for watching people, and I find human nature absolutely fascinating. And I used to do it purely to entertain myself. I'd, pick on some poor unsuspecting person on the bus or a train or at an airport and just make up a story about them, which I used to recant ad lib to whoever I was with. I just sort of had an idea running round in my head. And then when I sold my recruitment agencies and I'd lunched with everybody that I was due to catch up with, I decided to actually put something down finally once and for all and start. And I finished at 25,000 words thinking I'd got a whole book. Yes, boy, was I mistaken. And so it took quite a few years to actually learn how to get the craft right. And, it's just quite an interesting industry to be involved in. I met some brilliant people through it and made some really good friends. But it's just in me now, you know. I just sit down, plug in, don't suffer with writer's block. Well, I haven't done yet, she says, touching wood.
Yes.
My characters write themselves, really and truly.
Oh, how lovely.
I'm very much what they call a pantser. I don't plan. I fly by the seat of my pants and just open up the laptop and get on with it.
And was it obvious to you the kind of books that you wanted to write?
Not particularly. I'd always read sort of quite across the board, quite a wide range of things. I wasn't terribly into sort of fantasy and science fiction, but I liked a good thriller, and I liked a good saga. I loved the old-fashioned Catherine Cooksons and Maeve Binchy and people like that who really made their characters come to life and then brought them up in other books. And this was more or less the sort of route I went on. But I found I've got a bit more sort of crimey as I've gone on. There's always a hidden secret that threatens somebody's livelihood or their life in my later books. So, yeah, that's changed slightly.
So before we talk about A Date in the Diary series, I want to ask you a little bit about Accident of Fate and Accident of Birth.
Mm.
Without giving too much away, what can you tell us about them?
Well, Accident of Fate is, it's about four women and one man. And the man is Liam Riley. He's a despicable character, but he's a man that even respectable women turn their heads to. He's very good looking, very charismatic, until he's got you. And then after that, he's an absolutely horrible man. Of the four women, two love him. One hates him, and the other becomes mother to his child but has never actually met him. And it's about her story. It's about Joanna's story initially, and how she's hidden her childhood well and married well, and then something happens that is liable to threaten everything, and she goes on the hunt to try and find the link, who the link is to her child, and that finds its way into the book as a parallel. So I write it initially as Joanna, and then you get all of the women's lives running parallel to the last quarter of the book when you realise they are all linked and they all come together. And you find out whether or not Liam Riley gets his just desserts.
Wow. And then Accident of Birth follows on from that, does it?
Yes, it does, because without giving too much away, Accident of Fate finishes with...
Oh, don't tell us, don't tell us.
No. But it's left with a couple of... It's left with two of the parents that have to tell their children something, and they're flying back to the UK. So Accident of Birth takes up with the two children who aren't, they aren't children, they're in their 20s, and it's what happens to them. It's whether history repeats itself. It's whether or not you can reinvent yourself, whether you can do something so terrible that you can completely block it out of your mind and then just get on with your life and try and pretend it hasn't happened. But there's always something that will bring you back to it.
Mm. That's an interesting question, isn't it?
Mm.
Interesting yes. thought. I wonder yes. how many people out there have done something really, really bad and have carried on as normal. We meet a few of them in Spain.
Yes, I've met a few of them in Spain as well.
So looking at the next series, A Date in the Diary, so how many books are they going to be and when are they due to come out?
There's three, and as yet I'm still searching out for a publisher or indeed an agent that wants to take on a three-book series. Unfortunately, at the moment, it would appear that most publishers are sticking to one book at a time because they're saying that the market's a bit precarious, shall we say, at the moment. So, but the first and the second is complete, and the third, I've probably got a small amount left to write on it. It's tying up loose ends in it, and it's the big reveal in the third book. So although you think what's happened in one and then in two, you actually find the complete twist is in book three.
Okay, and it's the story of three women.
Three women that go to attend a boarding school from different walks of life, and they've more or less just got on with their lives and gone out into the big wide world. One's married a celebrity. Another has taken off and has had a very glamorous life in Sardinia. But it's what actually happens to them from when they receive the invitation and the person that they are then to the person they have become by the time they attend the reunion. And there's a very dark secret that they all share, that they've shared from the day that they left, and they made a pact never to discuss it. So now it's a time to go back and meet and find out how strong that bond is to still keep that secret and what they all think happened. Their own opinion now of where they think they were guilty in respect to how it happened.
Mm. The idea of a school reunion is such a fascinating concept, isn't it? I mean, I expect there's people listening who have done a school reunion and may or may not have enjoyed it, and people I expect who have thought about it, either in terms of, I can't think of anything worse, or wouldn't it be so interesting to do?
Well, I've actually done it myself.
Have you?
I went to boarding school years ago, yes, and it is fascinating because, you know, the person that was a shrinking violet is, you know, suddenly, I don't know, a top fashion photographer or something, but they turn up looking like they did when they were still at school, a complete no-no, in a white suit or something. I'm talking about the men here, in a white suit, you know, with the open top car, and you just think, nerd. And so although they've made it professionally, you know, they've still not grown out of the person that they were then.
How funny.
But no, and you all grow away, and we're spread far across the world now, and you know, obviously, you think about different things that happened there. I learned independence there, because of course your teachers become your parents.
Mm.
So I think it gives you a different perspective on life, a survival, definitely, because you're on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of Accident of Birth, which is the most recent book, which is out and available on our website, people can go to tre.radio and go to the bookshop section and get it there. And any publishers listening should get in touch, shouldn't they?
They should indeed. I'm ready to make them lots of money.
Ready and waiting. Brilliant.
Absolutely.
Sue McKendra, thank you so much for joining us. If listeners want more information about you and all of your books, they can have a look on your website, which is suemckendra.com.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
Thank you, Sue. Take care.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
This is Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Nicola Avery, who's a trained hypnotherapist, a past life therapist and Reiki practitioner. Nicola channels her research and experiences in past life regression and communication into her writing. She's with us on the book show to talk about her novel Within the Silence. It's a dark paranormal thriller which unpicks the perfect family tapestry. It's filled with mysterious twists, sinister discoveries, heartbreaking confessions, and a love so powerful it crosses even death. Welcome to the book show, Nicola.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. So at what point did you think, I know, I'm going to write a book?
I've always wanted to write. I was writing as a child, but as I grew, I had to do more practical things, and a career took place. I then sadly became a single mother, so I had to bring up my daughter, and the idea of writing a book was very much put on the back burner.
Mm. You had your own costume design business, didn't you? Sounds fun.
Yes. I did that while I was working full-time. I come from quite a theatrical background, so I think it was always within me. It needed to come out at some stage. So doing the costume design was something I did aside to my career, which allowed me to create some outrageous theatrical costumes for people to go to fancy dress parties and things like that. I had a lot of fun doing that. I didn't make any money from it, but sometimes our passions aren't things that we make money from.
True, absolutely. So tell me about the things that you've been doing more recently, training to be a hypnotherapist and past life therapist. How did you get into that?
Well, I did that a while back. That wasn't something I did recently. I'm an older lady, so I have lived somewhat. But I was always fascinated with the concept that I'd lived before. I would say things or travel to places where I felt instinctively as if I'd been there before. It was very difficult to explain, and it sometimes can sound a bit odd to other people who don't experience it. So it wasn't until my daughter had finished full-time education that I thought, I need to try and understand this. So I actually went to a past life therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I had quite an amazing experience, which made me want to know more. So I went away, decided that the best thing for me to do would be to study it myself. And so I did so and qualified, purely again to see it from the therapist's view, not just the individual's view, and understand how we can take somebody down to bring this sort of information up. And I just found it absolutely fascinating.
And are you able to then help other people to regress?
Yes, yes. As I said, I don't do that now. See, past life regression and past life therapies is a technique that uses hypnotherapy or deep relaxation methods.
Mm.
And what it does, it takes somebody backwards in time, back to their childhood, in some cases to their infancy. And by regressing, we can discover repressed traumatic events and bring this out to the conscious, which helps an individual to remember something. And by remembering it, the therapy has already started. A lot of our fears and phobias come from events that perhaps happened to us in the past, and we were unable to handle at that stage.
Mm.
It's quite a cathartic experience. Now, with this regression, on occasions, individuals do regress back further, and that's when they will start to relate a past existence.
How fascinating. And this has helped with your writing, has it?
Oh, yes, very much so. Because the first book, Whispered Memories, is actually based on the concept that we have lived before. And everything we see and we do and we feel can somehow be sparked by something that's happened to us in the past, but we're probably not even aware of it. So to be able to write about it as somebody who's experienced it or believes she's experienced it gave me so much scope. And those that have read it, you don't actually have to believe in past life to enjoy the story, because I think it's a powerful story, and the concept that things happened because of something that happened a long time ago makes it even more powerful, because you're meeting individuals that you've potentially met in another life. You're not necessarily the same sex, which is even more interesting. So it gives me so much depth. And having done one, I've been asked to do a sequel to Whispered Memories, and I think there is another chance for me to follow that route. Don't have a past life in Within the Silence, but we do have, obviously, the paranormal thread.
Fantastic. So tell us about some of the characters in Within the Silence.
I'm going to be careful here because I don't want to give too much away. We've got John Stone, who is a revered psychiatrist, and he's a doting husband and a loving father. He's a gentleman who has some secrets. We have his daughter, Maddie, who has a number of secrets. And we have Zara, which is Maddie's stepsister and actually her best friend, who will, as the book evolves, have to find out what these secrets are. She has to do this fairly fast because things are unraveling around her. But I can't tell you too much because I will actually ruin the story.
Okay, fair enough. So how did you find the process of writing this book compared to the first one?
It's always the same in that I write two, it sounds awful. I've only written two books, but there are so many books in my head and there's so many books in pieces around me. I write the first chapter and I write the last chapter. Those never change. When I was editing Whispered Memories, I spent a lot of time in Mallorca, which was actually brilliant because I could actually relax. And I think when I relax, things come into my mind freely. So within the silence was bobbing around the water with me in my head while I was trying desperately to edit the first book. So I was writing it alongside the editing for the first one. So when I reached a period where I felt a bit down or in despair because it's quite dark days when you write, because especially if you're covering subjects that are very emotional, you have to walk away. So having something else to dip into is really quite a good idea. So Within the Silence has always been bouncing around alongside. It's only the last year or so I've been able to really concentrate and get this one up to the level that I wanted.
And do you think there could be another book to follow on this one?
It won't follow on to this one, as in it'll be a different subject. But yes, I have another thriller that I'm working on. That, again, will have a paranormal element. I'm sorry, I do love that. I have to cross genres. I have to mix genres. I basically write about the things I'm interested in. Again, I do apologise, but I put everything in there that fascinates me.
Mm.
And I'm just hoping it's a bit like a box of chocolates without any sweet index. People will dip in it and get what they want.
Yes.
And I just, you know, this. I need to carry on. If I've got readers, I can carry on forever.
Exactly.
But otherwise, I can just carry on for myself.
Well, there's no need to apologise at all. I think most people write what they know and what they like. I think that's the whole point.
Yeah.
So I understand you're also working on a children's book.
Yes. It's a sort of children's book that I read as a child. And we're going back a bit here. It's a bit like the original Hans Christian Andersen stories. So there's always a moral in there. I don't know if you can cast your mind back to, say, the original Little Mermaid.
Yes.
Which actually is a terribly tragic, sad story. But the lesson you learn from it and the love and the devotion of the Little Mermaid and what she gives up to protect others and for pure love. I mean, it's just so beautiful. And I sort of want to go back to those days when I'm a grandmother, so I understand you don't want to frighten your child or you don't want to make your child upset. But sometimes sad things can be beautiful too. And I think I want to write something that moves the child and makes the child understand that sad things and bad things can happen. We all survive, we all come through, and life continues.
Mm. Oh, fantastic. That's a very powerful message. If people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called Within the Silence, and it's by Nicola Avery, who we've been chatting to. Nicola, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE, Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Nick Pope, who worked for the Ministry of Defence for 21 years, undertaking a wide range of jobs, mainly in the MOD's headquarters building in Whitehall. His final posting was as an acting deputy director in the Directorate of Defence Security. He's with us on the book show to talk about his book Blood Brothers. Welcome to the book show, Nick.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Thanks for joining us. So tell me, your journey from working for the Ministry of Defence to becoming an author, was it a long journey?
It was a long journey, and there were a few twists and turns on the way. I had one of the most amazing jobs in the whole department, actually, running their UFO programme. And through that, When I left, I got into the idea that I had some interesting stories to tell. But of course, I was bound by the Official Secrets Act, so I wasn't quite sure how that would pan out. But I wrote some nonfiction books on UFOs based on my government experience, and those needed to go through the security clearance process. And then much more recently, I thought, well, you know what, as well as the UFO side of things, I've got some other interesting things that I've done to do more with intelligence and counter-terrorism. And I thought I'd have a go at writing an action thriller.
Mm, absolutely. So before we talk about that, tell me a bit more about your work with UFOs. What did that entail? Can you talk about it now?
Yes, I can, but only because the government itself is declassifying and releasing most of the files that I worked on. So those have all ended up, or most of them, at the National Archives. And my job was to research and investigate the phenomenon to see if there was anything of any defense interest. And most of it turned out to be misidentifications and hoaxes. But in amongst all that, there were some fascinating cases where we had these things occasionally seen by pilots, chased in military aircraft, tracked on radar. And of course, just recently, we've had the revelations about the Pentagon's UFO program that after years of denial, it turns out the US government had a program too. So all this is very topical at the moment.
So had your opinion on UFOs changed throughout your time doing that job?
Yes, it had. I started off very cynical and skeptical about it, but I ended up, if not exactly a fully paid up believer in little green men, but certainly not being afraid to, I guess, look up and say, well, what if?
Yeah, wow. So you never saw anything yourself?
Sadly, no.
But you're open to the fact that there could be something else out there.
I don't see why not. In an infinite universe, it seems to me that there are almost an infinite amount of possibilities. So we always used to say at the MOD, the skeptics had to be right every day, but the believers only have to be right once.
Yes, interesting. So looking at the book then, Blood Brothers, as you say, it looks at terrorism and counterterrorism. Why did you go down that road for this?
It was to do with my last job. I mean, post 9/11, security in the MOD, which had been a bit of a backwater, was obviously the place to be. And to get involved with counterterrorism, intelligence work, to have the chance to go to places like Iraq and Kosovo, it put into my mind the idea of doing a book. And I thought, again, I didn't want to in any way compromise any operations or security. So I was quite happy to write the book at an unclassified level. And of course, it's fiction, not fact, which gives me a little bit more leeway. Having said that, of course, it is sadly, I'm afraid, based on some very real issues and concerns that the UK and other nations face every day.
Mm. It's set in London when two very different terror attacks take place.
Yes, I decided to go down the route of, I mean, it's the big danger with a book like this, I thought, was that you end up sort of demonizing Islam, or you know, you can get into a whole debate about all of that, but there's no getting away from the fact that there are terrorists, I guess, of any religious persuasion, and all throughout history there have been people who've used their religion maybe for more political ends. So I wanted to get into that, but I wanted to get away from all this sort of you know, black and white, good versus evil, and blur the lines a little bit with some of this.
So can you tell us about the two different incidences that happen?
Well, one is the bringing down of an aircraft during a Royal Air Force flypast with a Stinger ground-to-air missile. And the other is a more conventional suicide attack on a march in Soho. And as was the case in 9/11, what I've done with that is push the idea that one of these attacks was basically perpetrated by what you'd call the sort of muscle terrorists, just the thugs. But one is an extremely sophisticated and dangerous operator who's a different kettle of fish altogether.
It's interesting, isn't it? I often think when there is a terrorist attack that takes place, and I'm sure many others, worry whether that's a distraction, if you like, for something else to happen, because you always see on the television all the emergency services, quite rightly, go to the situation that has happened. And I always think, gosh, what if something awful was to happen the other side of the city, for example? What would happen then? Were you thinking along those lines as well?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's almost exactly how the first attacks unfold at the same time. Two very different attacks. And it's almost as if one is a distraction, or certainly the idea is to split the police so that they can't keep up. And then the momentum keeps on, and more attacks come out, and some people, some sympathizers within the UK community rise up. And I get into the idea that there are good people on both sides of this and bad people on both sides of this. And in one sense, there are heroes and villains in some unlikely places in Blood Brothers.
Mm. And in the book, the Prime Minister authorises the creation of a multi-agency team codenamed Artemis. Tell us about them.
Well, what I thought was one of the things that I'd seen in my Ministry of Defence career was that one of the problems that you always have in counterterrorism operations is poor information sharing. And we saw that on 9/11, of course, in the US with the subsequent revelation that information between the CIA and the FBI was not as freely exchanged as it should have been. And two people who should have been on everyone's radar slipped through the net. And so what I decided to do in Blood Brothers is bring together this multi-agency team, MI5, MI6, GCHQ, and the SAS, so that there's some military firepower attached to this group too. So it's brains and brawn, teeth and tail.
Fantastic. And can I ask you a bit about the title, Blood Brothers?
Blood Brothers goes to the heart of this without, I guess, well, I don't know how to do this without doing too many spoilers, but suffice to say that one of the characters who we think is a villain has a change of heart, or appears to have a change of heart. I'll readers will have to work through some of that. And two people on opposite sides of this struggle end up reluctantly having to work together. So in one sense, what I've done here is create a sort of buddy movie, or rather a buddy book, but of course it lends itself to TV and movie treatment.
Very clever. So how did you find writing this book compared to other books that you've written then?
I enjoyed it. I've written three non-fiction books and actually two sci-fi novels, but I far prefer writing fiction to non-fiction. I can just have more fun with it. That said, you can't make things up in these sorts of techno thrillers, because all the people that like this sort of thing and follow authors like Tom Clancy, for example, you get one detail wrong and they're absolutely on you in an instant, like, oh no, the magazine for that pistol carries 15 rounds, not 12. That's a sort of special forces variant. So it has to be meticulously researched. But no, it's as you would expect, hard work, but good fun too.
Yeah. Do you enjoy the research side of things?
Yes, I do. I like looking at something. So, for example, what weaponry are we using? What tactics are we using here? How would this work in real life? And of course, I had this inside knowledge from the MOD, but then I had this additional challenge that actually, on occasion, because I've got this inside knowledge, I actually don't want to be too accurate, because I don't want, even in fictional form, to write about things that might give away some secrets about strategy, tactics, doctrine, weaponry, give that away to any of the bad guys.
No, that's true. Absolutely. Do you think you're going to do more books along these lines?
Yes, absolutely. I've created a sort of ensemble cast of characters here, my core team, not just the good guys on the Artemis team, but some of the bad guys too. And my intention is to carry on with this fictional universe. And I'm already working on a sequel called Old Enemies, which is going to look at the whole Northern Ireland situation in the context of Brexit. And again, I want to make this all, very topical and current, and maybe a little bit too current. I mean, some of this is quite dark.
Mm. Well, it's been great to chat to you, Nick Pope. Thank you very much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of Blood Brothers, it's out now and available to buy in our bookshop section on the website tre.radio. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
TRE. Online at tre.radio.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Andy Shepherd, a children's writer working on middle grade fiction and picture books. She's with us on the book show to talk about the third book in a fabulous series. It's called The Boy Who Flew with Dragons. Welcome to the book show, Andy.
Thanks very much. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for being with us. So when did writing start for you? How long have you been doing it for now?
I suppose seriously for about 8 years, but I've always dabbled with writing. As from a kid, but only sort of really seriously for the last 8 years, I guess.
And why children's books?
Mainly because it was telling stories to my kids that got me back into writing. I love children's books. It's something I've always read children's books, and lots of my favourite books are still children's books. So when I started telling stories to my kids, it was just a very natural step to writing them down. And I just love it.
So tell us about this series then. Do you know how many there's going to be?
Well, there's currently three. So the first one came out in June. That was The Boy Who Grew Dragons. And then in September, we had The Boy Who Lived with Dragons. And this is the final one of these three, which is called The Boy Who Flew with Dragons. And it started out as one book, actually. But I developed the sort of story arc into three books. So this is kind of the last part of that arc, if you like.
And what kind of age are we aiming the books at?
They're pitched at 7 to 9, but they've been used in schools from sort of 5 or 6 up to 10.
Okay.
It's a very narrow band, but I'm glad to say that people are a lot younger and a lot older have been enjoying them, which is great.
Oh, great. So as a children's author, are there kind of guidelines that you have to stick to? Do you have to be really careful about the language that you're using, the kind of words that you use and all that kind of thing?
Not really, no. I mean, you have to be aware of your audience, but I don't dumb it down or anything. If there are words there that a 7-year-old might not know, then they can find out, and that's part of the joy of writing, is that you come across things that you wouldn't normally come across. There is a certain word count, so you wouldn't write a 70,000 word book for a 7-year-old, but mine are kind of probably at the slightly longer end. They're about 30,000, but anywhere between sort of 15,000 and 30,000 for that age group is about the right level, really.
Okay.
But in terms of language, I don't tend to hold back.
Oh, that's good. And so tell us about this little boy and his dragons.
Well, it's a story about Thomas, and he's a little boy who finds a very strange plant at the bottom of his granddad's garden. And he takes this very strange spiky fruit back to his house, and he discovers exactly why it's called a dragon fruit. And it's really a story about Thomas and the little dragon Flicker that hatches from this fruit. So there's lots of fun and games and chaos. One of the things about dragons is that they poo a lot, and their poo is highly explosive when it dries out. So it's quite difficult and challenging to keep a dragon. But it's also, I wanted the books to be full of heart. So it's really a story about family and friendship, and really about finding the magic in your everyday world, really.
And is it important for you when writing children's books to have kind of a message in there somewhere as well as a great story?
It is for me personally. It's not a sort of a message as such, but just I find that my books sort of really sort of start to spark in my head when I have that heart moment. So when I feel that little tingle of like, that's why I want to tell this story. So I often start with a setting or an idea or a character, but until I get that kind of little heart moment of why this story needs to be happening, that's when things really start coming together for me. So yeah, it's important for me, I think, when I'm writing them, definitely.
And do you plan quite a lot beforehand? Do you come up with the ideas of the characters and then sort of put the plot together, or do you just start writing?
It's been different for every book, to be honest. The first book I ever wrote was very much, I just sat down and started writing, and I developed the plot and the idea as I went along. For this book, when I started writing it, I just sat down and started writing, I basically had a really crushing rejection for one of my other books, and I decided to go back to writing just what I love to write, just for my sons. So I wrote this really just for them, and I'd sort of write a chapter every day, and they'd come back from school and ask me all about it and listen to it, and the story just grew, and I wrote this book. And then when my agent sent it to London Book Fair and we got some interest, I then had to start working on the book with an editor. And obviously then I started shaping it and changing it, and it's developed and it's actually become three books. But the original arc of the first book is there. It's just now over three books. So my plotting has definitely gone up a gear. And the more I do, the more I plot, basically, because I don't really have the time to go off on major tangents. So I like to be quite clear now about what I'm doing. But I still sort of tend to do quite a lot of sort of what I call dreaming about it and thinking about it before I'll actually start writing. And then I might write perhaps the first chapter to get an idea of the voice or the tone, and then I realise that I haven't got a plot, so then I go off and do the plotting. So it's quite important to get a little bit of the voice there, and I'll often do that very early on, and then I'll leave the writing and do plotting at that point.
And has it been nice to write a series? Do you think you might do that again?
Well, it's funny because I didn't set out to write a series at all. And I say it started off as this one book. And in my head, it was just one book. But it's actually been really wonderful to do it over three books, because obviously I've had so much more room to develop the characters. There are new storylines that I never imagined might appear. So I have really enjoyed it. But I think I would also like to do a standalone book as well. But yeah, I'd never say never.
You can do both.
Yeah, I can do both. Let's hope so.
Well, if people want to get a copy of The Boy Who Flew with Dragons, it's out now by Andy Shepherd, and it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. Andy, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, very welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.